chapter 3 and also chapter 7. Song of Solomon, chapter 3, we'll read the first 4 verses. By night, on my bed, I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. I will rise now and go about the city in the streets and in the broad ways. I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. The watchmen that go about the city found me, to whom I said, Saw ye him whom my soul loveth? It was but a little while that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him, would not let him go, until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chambers of her that conceived me. Then in chapter 7, read verses 10 through verse 13. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early in the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourisheth, whether the tender grape appear, and the pomegranates bud forth. There will I give thee my loves. The mandrakes give a smell, and at our gates are all manner of pleasant fruits, new and old, which I have laid up for thee, O my beloved. As we know, in Song of Solomon, there are two main characters, a man and a woman. They are basically in the position of a bridegroom and a bride. And these two are seen throughout the book. They're in love. They're communing with one another. And they also speak of one another. Throughout the book, we see them and we hear them expressing their love for one another. And this man and woman, of course, but first and foremost, I believe, portray the love relationship between Christ and his bride. And then, of course, there are many personal applications for the individual child of God as well. The Song of Solomon is a love song, and that's what our lives ought to be. It ought to be a love song of Christ. Now, in the verses that we've read for our text, we, in both passages, the woman is declaring her love for this man. And we see that the love that she has for him has great effect upon her life, has great effect upon her person, great effect upon her day. And that's what we want to speak upon this evening, is our days marked by the love of our life. And in this message, we want to consider and observe her love to him and make the correlation, see a correlation to our love to Christ. First of all, we need to stress the importance of love to the Lord. We are commanded, Deuteronomy 6 and verse 5 and other places, to love the Lord. And we're to do so with all of our heart, to do so with all of our soul, with all of our might. In other words, it is to be a love that involves our entire being, every part of us. It is a love in which nothing is to interfere. Again, if we're to love him with all of our heart, all of our soul, and all of our mind, Nothing else is to interfere. It's to be all. It's to be wholehearted. So it is a love in which nothing is to interfere. Christ referred to this love of the Lord, this command to love the Lord, in Matthew 22, verses 36 through 38, as the greatest commandment. The greatest commandment. The most important of all the commands. Paul reiterated that in 1 Timothy 1 and verse 5. He said, "Now the end of the commandment is charity out of a pure heart." So the law of God commands us to love God. But the law or command never produces love to God. No one loves God because the law commands him to do so. No one. Love does not produce, or the law does not produce this love. So, love for the Lord is not merely a decision that someone makes. You read the command and you say, "Well, I think I'll obey that command and I'll start loving the Lord today." No one does that. Because love is not just a decision that you make. You don't just decide to love someone. You don't just decide to love the Lord. It's plainly stated in 1 John 4, verse 19, we love Him because He first loved us. So love to the Lord is the direct result of a personal experience of His love to us. Not the result of a command. So why does God command us to love Him then? If we don't love Him as a result of command, why does He even command us to love Him? I believe to stress the importance of such love. Again, the way He commands us with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our might. It stresses the importance of love to God. The importance of love to God is seen in the fact that it is foundational. It is foundational to a relationship with the Lord. You cannot have a personal relationship with the Lord without love to the Lord. It's foundational. I believe it's also foundational to all true service to the Lord. And we say true service because people can go through the motions of service without love. But true service requires that we love the Lord. And true service is the result of love to the Lord. If someone loves the Lord, they will serve the Lord. You don't have to try and convince them to serve God. You might as well try to convince them to love God. Neither one's going to work. But we serve God because we love the Lord. The importance of love to God is that it is a fountain. The greater our love, the more committed, the more surrendered we want to be. The greater our love, the more we want to obey Him. The more we want to glorify Him. People who are always trying to find loopholes and ways around obeying God have little to no love for the Lord. Because the more we love God, the more we want to obey Him. The more important it becomes to us to obey Him and to glorify Him in that. The greater our love, the more we want to worship Him. You can't command someone, I mean you can, but it's not going to... To say, you worship God. person doesn't worship God because they're commanded to, just like they don't love God because they're commanded to. It all flows together. The truth is, the greater our love to the Lord, the more we love His Word, the more we love His people, and all things that concern the Lord. The greater our love to the Lord, the more He becomes our purpose for living. And the more meaningful our lives become. The most meaningful lives are those who love the Lord. And the importance of love to the Lord is seen from the fact that it's very closely related to our outlook upon life, our attitudes, our desires, our interests, our goals, and our aims. I mean, the more we love God, the more God is involved in our desires and our interests and our goals and our aims. So love to God will keep priorities right. No problem with priorities if we love God first and foremost. But if you don't love God first and foremost, then priorities are not going to be right. So love to God will keep our priorities right. And by keeping priorities right, we keep a lot of harmful things out of our lives. People bring a lot of harmful things in their lives simply because their priorities are all messed up. So the importance of love for the Lord is seen from the fact that it guards our hearts, tends to fortify our minds, causes us to be resolute in the cause of the Lord. And we read in Jude verse 21 that we are to keep ourselves in the love of God. That doesn't mean that we keep ourselves in a condition that God love us, because God's love is uninfluenced. But it means that we're to pay attention to our love to God. We're to always be examining our love to the Lord, because it is so important. And the word keep, of course, means to keep yourselves in love of God, means to retain it, to continue loving God, to persist in loving the Lord. It also serves as a warning. Keep yourselves. That is, do not part with love for the Lord. Do not set aside your love to God. It means that we're to guard our love to God. We're to garrison our love to God. And the very fact that it needs guarding implies that there is a threat, and that there is a danger, and there is a possibility of loss. There is a possibility that we lose our love for the Lord. The word keep, again, keep yourselves in the love of God, suggests personal diligence on our part, energy on our part. Conveys the idea that it's important, it's worth keeping, it's valuable. Love to the Lord. Keep yourselves in the love of God. Because it is our tendency to fail in this matter. It is our tendency to fail to feed our love to the Lord. Love needs to be fed. Love to God, love for God, needs feeding. And it is possible, as seen from Christ's statement in Matthew 24, verse 12, because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. So it's possible that our love lose its fervency. It can wax cold. We see what Jesus said to the church of Ephesus in Revelation 2, verse 4, "Thou hast left thy first love." If they did, cannot we? Certainly we can. Our love can grow cold. We can leave our love. Love to God can become stagnant. Can become mechanical. Just going through the motions. It's possible that, and I believe this is what it means when it says they left their first love. I don't believe they left Christ altogether. First love describes a degree of love. It's possible for love to lose its glow, its radiance, its wonder, its fervency, its passion. Happens all the time between husbands and wives. We're talking about a love even more important than love between a husband and wife. We're talking about love for the Lord. It's possible that that love lose its excitement and its interest and its joy. And we're prone to allow all of those things to happen. Every one of us are prone to let those things happen. And here in Song of Solomon, we want to take notice of this woman's love and the effect that it had upon her life. The comparison, of course, being with our love to the Lord. Now, in the text in chapter 3, she declares the love of her life. We need to be honest enough to make personal examination and truthfully answer the question, what or who is the love of our life? But here in chapter 3, she says four times, "Him whom my soul loveth." Him whom my soul loveth. In chapter 7, the verses we read there, she refers to him three times as her beloved. Her beloved. 23 times in the book of Song of Solomon, she refers to him as her beloved. Three times she refers to him as my love. So each time she uttered those words, him whom my soul loveth, my beloved, my love, she was stating that he was the love of her life. He was the love of her life. Now, the love of her life was a person, a real person. When she speaks of the object of her love, him whom my soul loveth, my beloved, my love, she does not speak in abstract. She does not speak of the object of her love as an idea or a theory or a doctrine. But the object of her love is a real person. Now, I love the doctrines of the Word of God. But there is a danger that if we're not careful, it is possible, it's not only possible, it's probable that we love a doctrine and not the person of the Lord. In our text, chapter 3, there are 15 pronouns relating to the one whom she loves. 15 pronouns in those four verses. And in the text in chapter 7, she speaks of the object of her love again as a real person. One that she had a personal knowledge and experience of. In order to love the Lord, you have to have a personal knowledge of Him. And you have to have a personal experience of Him. And the more our knowledge and our experience grows, the more our love grows. We see she had a personal knowledge of Him. She had a personal experience of Him. She had a personal connection to Him. He was a reality in her life. We must beware that Christ not cease to be a personal reality in her life. He was the love of her life. Notice also her love for Him was certain. She speaks not only with a realization of His person, who He is, but she speaks with assurance of her love to Him. In other words, she did not say, "I think I love Him more than anyone else." She spoke of her love, and it was not a matter of conjecture. "Him whom my soul loveth." My beloved. My love. Her love to Him was personal, and her love to Him was very certain. Again, she says, "Him whom my soul loveth, my beloved, my love." And as you look at those words, there's not a hint of doubt anywhere. She speaks with a tone of surety. She speaks with a tone of confidence. And I believe she speaks with clear conscience. "Him whom my soul loveth." These were not just words to her. They were reality. And it is truly wonderful, it is truly a wonderful thing for a child of God to know without any doubt in their mind and with a clear conscience that they love the Lord. That they love Christ. To be able to say with Peter, "Lord, Thou knowest that I love Thee." Lord, You know. You know that I love Thee. So again, personal examination is needed. Can I honestly say to the Lord, "You are the love of my life"? Now, anybody can say that, but can we honestly look to the Lord and say, "You are the love of my life. Nothing is before Thee. You are the one. You are the love of my life." Her love to Him was in the present tense. Again, in our text in chapter 3, it is, "He whom my soul loveth." It is present. It is continuous. In chapter 7, it is, "My beloved." In other words, the one being loved by me. My beloved. The one being loved by me. That ought to be true. Every day. that Jesus Christ is the one being loved by you and I. My beloved. Again, beloved. Being loved. A continuous love to the Lord, continuous love for the Lord, is a growing love. It is an ever-increasing love. It gets greater by the day. Also, her love for him was very deep. The world hardly knows what love is, and in most cases, the love that the world speaks of is very, very, very shallow at best. Her love for the Lord was very deep. There are many who profess love to the Lord, and many who profess love to the Lord have none whatsoever. There are others who have a very shallow love for the Lord. There are some who have a very deep love for the Lord. And that's who we desire to be identified with. She says, him whom my soul, that speaks of the depth of her love, whom my soul loveth. Nothing shallow about her love. My soul. That means it is a love that consumed her heart. It was a love that consumed her mind and her life. She was absolutely consumed with Christ. The truth is, if we're not consumed with him, can you honestly say that he's the love of your life? I don't think so. If he's the love of our life, then we're consumed. He consumes our thoughts. Consumes our heart. He consumes our life. Him whom my soul loveth. It is a love that reached the inner depths of her being. It took control of her. It took control of her heart, her mind, her life. Again, love does not bypass the heart. And it does not bypass the mind. And it does not bypass the emotions. And it does not bypass the life. That's true with human-to-human love. That's true concerning our love to the Lord. Love does not bypass the heart and the mind. Does not bypass the emotions. Try to divorce emotions from love. It can't be done. It does not bypass the life. Yet, there are people who want us to believe that they have a love for the Lord that has completely bypassed their heart and their mind and their emotions and their life. But love never bypasses those things. So it's not a flash-in-the-pan experience. When she says, him whom my soul loveth, she's speaking of the fact that she was taken completely up with him. It was a love that was fervent. It was a love that was intense. A love that could not be contained. She could not contain it. When she said, him whom my soul loveth, when she used the word soul, she's attempting to describe a feeling and an emotion that is beyond description. my soul loveth. It was a love without reservation. Him whom my soul loveth. That's a love that does not hold back. That's a love without reservation. Also, her love for him was public. Chapter 3 and verse 3, she asked the watchman, "Saw ye him whom my soul loveth?" In chapter 5 and verse 8, she said to the daughters of Jerusalem, "If ye find my beloved, tell him that I am sick with love." Again, it affected her entire being. And also to the daughters of Jerusalem in chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 8, verse 4, she referred to him as my love. Again, all of that was public. She was unashamed of her love for him. She was unashamed of him. She was uninhibited to declare her love for him to others. Her love was public. It was a love that was openly manifested. When she said those words, "Him whom my soul loveth, my beloved, my love," you notice when she spoke those words to the watchmen or to the daughters of Jerusalem, not one single time did they ever ask her, "Who are you talking about?" They knew. They knew. They knew who the love of her life was. How did they know that? Because she had outwardly demonstrated her love to him. Our love for the Lord ought to be public. It ought to be public. We ought to outwardly demonstrate our love for the Lord. People ought to know. People should not have to be around us too long to know that we love the Lord. You shouldn't have to be around us too long at all to know that. Others could see plainly who the love of her life was. Speaking to her, they said in chapter 5, verse 9, chapter 6, verse 1, "Thy beloved." Thy beloved. They recognized who she loved. Four times in chapter 5, verse 9, and chapter 6, verse 1, they referred to him as thy beloved. Chapter 8, verse 5, they said her beloved. Her testimony was this: "He is the love of my life." That's a good testimony. That's a good testimony. He is the love of my life. Because if we have that testimony, everything else falls in place. He is the love of my life. Her love to him was a love of priority. Every time she said, "In him whom my soul loveth, my beloved, my love," not only was it a declaration of her love, but it was also a statement of her priority. It was a love that exceeded all others. And hence, he was the center of her interest. He's the love of her life, therefore he is the center of her interest. What is the center of our interest? That's something we need to examine. He was the focal point of her life. He was what gave her life meaning. He had a preeminent place in her life. And if Christ is the love of our life, then He will be the center of our interest. He's not just something on the side that we fit in. If He's the love of our life, He's the center of our interest. It means He's the focal point of our life. He has a preeminent place in our life. And it's the love of our life that defines our motives. It's the love of our life that defines our purposes and our viewpoints. It's the love of our life that defines our goals and our desires. It's the love of our life that defines our pursuits in life. So again, love for the Lord will prevent misplaced values, misplaced loyalties. And these misplaced values and misplaced loyalties always result in the endless pursuit of the secondary. The love for the Lord fixes that. When He's the love of our life, our lives are not filled with clutter. It's when we have all these other interests that begins to fill our life with clutter. Here's this is a truth. Love for the Lord simplifies life. It really does. It simplifies our life. Why is it today that most of God's people, their lives are anything but simple? Love for the Lord simplifies life. It really does. Because it keeps a lot of the other junk out. So He is the love of her life. It was a love of priority. Now notice, her love for Him had an impact upon her life. Love always has an impact. It always has an impact upon the one who loves. There cannot be love without an impact. There is no such thing. He was the love of her life, and therefore He was relevant to her life. How can someone be the love of your life and they not be relevant to your life? That's not possible. If Christ is the love of our life, then He must be relevant to her life. By that, we simply mean that He was pertinent to her life. He was connected and related to her life. If the Lord is the love of our life, He's connected to our life. He's related to our life. And we see this all through Song of Solomon. Notice in chapter 1, verse 13 and verse 14, this is the woman speaking. A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night betwixt my breasts. My beloved is unto me as a cluster of camphor in the vineyards of En-Gedi. What I want you to notice is, verse 13, my beloved unto me. You see a connection there? There's a relation. My beloved unto me. We see in verse 14, my beloved is unto me. Verse 10 of chapter 2, my beloved spake and said unto me. So you see the two are related. She and he. There's a connection between them. There's a link He's pertinent to her life. She said in chapter 2 and verse 16, "My beloved is mine, and I am his." And she said in chapter 6, verse 3, she reverses the order. She says, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine." There's a bond. There's a bond. There's an attachment. There's a togetherness. And this is what it means for the Lord to be our life. There's a bond with Him. There's an attachment. We're together with Him. There's common ground. There's agreement. Again, she wasn't in love with a doctrine. She's in love with a real person. And this person had a continuous impact in her life. That's what it means for the Lord to be the love of our life. He has an impact in our life. Notice in our text in chapter 3, he was the object of her thoughts. In verse 1, it's night, and she's in bed. And it's obvious from what is said that he was upon her mind and upon her heart. The psalmist said in Psalm 63 and verse 6, "When I remember thee upon my bed and meditate upon thee in the night watches." He was upon her mind. So her love for him impacted her thoughts, even in the night hours, when she was lying in bed. He impacted her thoughts. He was also the object of her pursuit. Again, in verse 1, it is nighttime. She's in bed. And while in bed, she twice says, "I sought him. I sought him." And then she says, "But I found him not." She's thinking upon him. She wants to be near him. She begins to seek him. "But I found him not." So she's come to realize that there's a distance between them. Because of her love and attachment to him, she knew when things weren't right. When we love the Lord, He's the love of our life, we know. No one has to tell us. We know when things aren't right. You love somebody, they don't have to tell you. You know when things aren't right. You know that. Now, there are many that I've talked to through the years, and you have too, who they don't know if they're right with God or not. Well, that speaks volumes. Let me tell you this, if you don't know, you're not. But that speaks volumes concerning their love. Because if He's the love of our lives, we know. We know when things are not right. And even more importantly, because of her love to Him, she could not be content in that state. "I sought Him, but I found Him not." She couldn't go to sleep in that state. Why? Because of the depth of her love for Him. Love for the Lord is sensitive to distance from Him. Not only is it sensitive to distance from Him, it cannot be content with distance from the Lord. Notice verse 2. Again, the last words of verse 1 is, I found him not. Verse 2, I will rise now. I will rise now. Love was not going to allow her to put this off. I will arise now and go about the city and the streets and in the broad ways will I seek him. This was not a matter of convenience. It's nighttime. She's in bed. She has to get up from the bed, get dressed, and go out into the streets. But she could not be content that she could not find him. She could not be content with a distance between her and he. And in verse 3, well, in verse 2, she goes about the city. She asks, well, she sought him, but I found him not. She comes upon the watchman and she asks, saw ye him whom my soul loveth? She is seeking. Love for the Lord will not allow you to be at a distance from him. Love to the Lord will cause you to rise in the most inconvenient times and seek him, because you cannot go on separated from him. Not if he's the love of your life. So you see, if he's the love of your life, you're not going to get too far from him. Love won't allow it to happen. It just won't allow it to happen. She could not continue without finding him. So she continues to seek. And then, again, we see he was the object of her activity. I sought him twice in verse 1. In verse 2, I will seek him, and I sought him. In verse 3, I said, saw ye him? In verse 4, I found him. And in verse 4, I held him. Notice everything revolves around him. That's what happens when someone's the love of your life. Everything revolves around that. People can say what they want, but what your life revolves around pretty much declares the love of your life. And everything here revolves around him. Then notice in chapter 7, and we'll close. She desired that they be together. In verse 11, come, my beloved, let us go forth. That ought to be the beginning of our every day. Let us go forth. If he's the love of your life, you don't want to go forth without him. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourisheth. It's us. She wanted to live life with him. And if Christ is the love of our lives, then we want to live life with him. And then she closes in verse 13 by saying, or in verse 12, I'm sorry, there will I give thee my loves. She desires to show him her love. She loves him. She wants to show her love for him. He is to be the love of our life. And it ought to be our desire every single day. How can I express my love for him? Do you do it by not talking to him? Is that how you express love? Do you do it by neglecting him and ignoring him? That's not how love is expressed. But we ought to be looking every day for ways to express our love for Him. Telling Him every day, I love you, Lord. Expressing it with our activities and our lives. So we have to ask, is Jesus Christ the love of our life? Looking at this woman in Song of Solomon, we see the glow, the passion, the excitement and the joy of her love to Him. All through the book, we see her talking to Him. All through the book, we see Him talking to her and her listening and her listening. She talks to Him. She listens to Him. Chapter 8, verse 5, she's leaning upon Him. Position of confidence and dependence. Our lives ought to be marked by our love for the Lord. It can't be replaced. Love for the Lord cannot be replaced with anything else. If you lack love for the Lord, trying to do more in His service will not replace it. That'll just create a religion of formality. We have to always examine our love. This is why the Lord asked Peter 3 times, "Lovest thou me?" The Lord knew Peter loved Him. But Peter needed to examine his love. And Peter said, "Lord, thou knowest that I love thee." And all, I hope that we can say that tonight. "Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. Not like I ought, but I love you." And we ought to pray that God would help us, that God would cause us to love Him more. Because that will fix a lot of things. Just love the Lord. You love the Lord, you want to do what's right. You want to do what's right. You want to bring glory to His name. You love the Lord, you don't struggle with whether or not you should worship Him, whether or not you should go to His house. You love the Lord, you just do those things. And if He's the love of your life, then He's the priority. A lot of people, something's always in the way. Something's always in the way. And they'll say, "Well, when I get this out of my life, then I'll be in church." No, you won't. Because there'll be something else. Because you see, this is not the problem. Whatever the this is. The problem is, folks do not love the Lord enough. Get that right, and all these other things become non-issues. A lot of things become non-issues when He's the love of our lives. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us in verse